time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show is heard every Saturday morning, 7:30 a.m. in northeastern Ohio on WJCU 88.7 FM and streamed at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for June 13th, 2020. This week's show tries to put some perspective on the events of not only the past 2 weeks, but also the raw realities that have emerged about everything we might have been taught when we were in school and what we think we see in the news and on the streets today, and how the bicycle can be a symbol for both good and bad. As we try to untangle and understand all of the things that are happening, from COVID-19 and its profound effects on our lives and the economy, to the horrific and sickening death of George Floyd and the subsequent global outcries for equity and justice, I turn to my friends and supporters at Bike Law for some perspectives you may not have heard yet. Peter Wilborn, who is the founder of Bike Law, actually started out as a civil rights attorney. In fact, in 2016, Peter wrote a piece for the Bike Law blog titled, Biking is a Civil Right. Rachel Maney, who is the National Bike Law Director, has some very personal connections to discrimination and civil rights herself. So today, Rachel and I take a look at everything from statistics and consequences to illustrations how inequities show up in everyday situations. Then after a break, I speak with Sergeant Mike Ware, the VP and Public Information Officer for IPIMBA, the International Police Mountain Bike Association. IPIMBA is a nonprofit association dedicated to promoting the use of bikes for public safety, providing resources and networking opportunities, and offering the best, most complete training for public safety cyclists. So let's head on down to Florida to speak with Bike Law's Rachel Maney. Hi, Rachel. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being here. These are some incredibly troubling times, but I want to preface our conversation with the disclaimer that Bike Law, and Rachel is the National Director of Bike Law, is a sponsor of the Outspoken Cyclist podcast. That does not in any way negate anything we're going to say today. How are you?
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate you having me back. I agree completely with everything you said. These are some unprecedented times, and I think that we are all in a place where if we're not ready, we need to be ready to have some difficult conversations. So I appreciate you having me.
We're going to cover a lot today, and it'll probably end up being a two-parter, maybe, or we'll try to get it all in today. I really don't know, but however far it goes, I want to continue the conversation because it's relevant. It's right now. So you have such a personal and deeply rooted perspective in racial issues, and we're facing them today. We face them as cyclists. We face them as women. We face them as somebody who isn't white. Now, I'm white, but I'm Jewish, so I've faced them in different ways.
Sure.
You're Korean. You've faced them, and you have African-American people in your firm. So let's talk about the work you and Peter are doing at Bike Law and where it starts, which I think you said you wanted to start with COVID-19, which seems to have changed a lot of things.
It really, really has. To go back even further and to speak just very briefly on about Peter and the work that he has done and continues to do, you know, Peter was his career is built upon the practice of civil rights law. You know, he left Geneva, Switzerland, and he came to the U.S. and was mentored by Armin Dörfner, who has a very, very significant and important role previously and still today in the civil rights world. And I think after a period of time, kind of dovetailing with the loss of Peter's brother, you know, Jim Wilborn was killed while riding his bicycle in 1998. Peter recognized that he had a skill set and that there was something inside of him that told him that he needed to protect and advocate for another group of people, and they kind of came together seamlessly. As we move forward, you are correct. So I am Korean American. I'm adopted. I'm half Jewish. And we do have someone in our firm who is Black, also a woman. And so for us, our nuclear bike law family, just as far as Peter and I are concerned, we have very, very personal sensitivities to what's going on in the world around us. As far as COVID is concerned, I think that there is a direct correlation to some of the things that we're seeing in the world around us outside of the viral pandemic. So, for example, only less than 16 or less than 17, 16.5% of Hispanics and only 19% of Blacks in this country are able to telework. And what we're seeing as a result is a huge disparity in the way that this virus is impacting communities of color. So, Black people account for 70% of the mortality rate with this virus. That's significantly disproportionate when we consider the fact that Black people account for only 13.5% of our entire U.S. population. That number, 70%, is really interesting because it's also the same percentage of crash fatalities amongst the same community of people. So people of color account for 70% of all crash fatalities in this country. Last year, there were 857 of them in total number of cycling fatalities in this country. Those things are related. We talk about equity in all facets of life, but I don't know if we can even begin that conversation without talking about access to power. So as a comprehensive cycling organization outside of legal representation for members of our cycling community, we also look at things like advocacy and engineering or infrastructure implementation and then policy. The people in this country that are responsible for doing those things are comprised of a group that is 88 or 89% white.
And male.
Right. So, before we can even look at finding mitigating solutions for all of these problems, we all have to be starting from the same place. This is a phrase that Peter uses frequently, and it's really apropos these days that some of us are born on third base and some of us aren't. And that is the inequity that needs to be fixed before we can begin trying to iron out all of these other things.
Let me remind our listeners, you're speaking with Rachel Maney. She is the director of bike law, the national director of bike law. They are headquartered, I think you're headquartered in Florida now, right?
We are. And it's interesting because we toyed with the idea, we have a DC office of making that our national headquarters. But instead, we decided that it is the state in this country that is afflicted the worst with crash fatalities and injuries that really needed to be the central hub for where we're doing our work.
And that makes perfect sense. It's also a pretty big COVID-19 state. I mean, it seems if you want to add that back in there with all of the other problems that we are having right now.
It is. And Florida is an interesting place because when Peter and I moved here, we were taken aback and very surprised by how wonderful and welcoming the cycling community was just because of how spread out and how diverse it is. One of the problems or the things that has contributed to, I think, the most significant variable is that there's a lot of separated land usage here in Florida. So we've got, Sunbelt auto sprawl as well as separated land usage. And so the cycling community here is forced or relegated to traveling on roadways that, of course, are not designed with them in mind. And it's just nice. The weather is great, pretty much year round. So there are all of these factors and variables, but Florida isn't any different than any other state in the country when we look at the disproportionality in how cycling fatalities or collisions or injury-causing crashes, as well as some of these fundamental human and civil rights issues, are impacting socioeconomically disadvantaged communities or communities that are predominantly made of people of color.
Recently, and I don't remember when it was maybe 3 months ago, 4 months ago, a young man riding with his team. This was such a stark incident of this. Blew through a stop sign. So did the young man he was riding with. A policeman stopped him and handcuffed him and took him off to jail while the other kid rode away. Not that that is even the most important thing. And, you know, the way it started to look is that it was clearly a bias on the part of the police that the young man was Latino, I think.
So his name is Javier.
Yes, Javier.
He is Puerto Rican. And so, yeah, the story that you just told, that narrative is mostly true. I just to fill in a couple little details. It was Javier and one of his cycling friends, a young man of the same age, 18 years old, and they were part of a little sprint breakaway from the group with whom they were riding. And this is a ride they do every Saturday morning. The stop sign, at which he did not come to a complete stop, is where the road that they were traveling on T-boned with another. And so they made that left. They slowed and made the left. And before they knew it, Javier was being handcuffed and tossed in the back of the deputy sheriff's vehicle, and he was hauled off to jail. And he was, charged as a criminal, treated like a felon. And it was probably, just in that very short moment of time, the longest 8.5, almost 9 hours that Javier's mother and father, his father who was on the ride with him, had ever experienced, because they were not given a clear explanation as to, one, why their son and not the other cyclist was being arrested, and two, when he'd be released. There were just a lot of variables that, until we received the deputy sheriff's dash cam and body cam, all one can do is speculate based on the optics.
Right.
So, at this point, we feel incredibly grateful, because with the wonderful partnership with a Central Florida criminal defense attorney named Dave Webster, we were able to get the state's attorney's office to drop the charges. And Javier, from the very beginning, has always taken the position that, I know that I should have come to a complete stop at the stop sign. I am not looking to shirk my responsibility or personal accountability for following the traffic laws. His position has also been, from the beginning, I don't understand why I'm being treated this way. And so, when we get involved in things like that, we are looking at a variety of different things as we strategize about how to best help the individual or individuals. And one of the things that was very, very high on our list of consideration was how pushing this forward or pushing on it harder was going to impact Javier and his family. And I think that that is in and of itself a significant problem, that people who, against whom are discriminated, or people who have suffered injustices or indignities because of the biases or predisposed assumptions or just blatant bigotry of those who are in positions of authority or power, we are sort of finding ourselves more and more being backed into a corner where we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. To speak up, we are confronted with the false narrative that somehow, we're constantly presenting ourselves as a community of people that are victims. Or, for example, the idea of being labeled the angry Black man or angry Black woman, right? So there are all these layers of nuance that have to be considered for people who are already taking on the greater amount of burden when trying to just exist and live and pursue happiness the same way that everybody else is able to do without complication.
Once again, I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Rachel Maney. She is the National Director for Bike Law. We're going to take a real quick break and we'll be right back. It's a fascinating conversation. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Okay, we are back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Rachel Maney. She is the National Director for Bike Law. And as you can well imagine, lots of things are going on right now in the law community, the legal community, the policing community, and of course the cycling community, and it's all connected. And that is something I do want to talk about, and that is police, racism, transportation culture. It seems like it is all connected somehow. And a lot of people are calling for defunding or abolishing police, which, you know, that's sort of the pendulum swinging too far in one direction, I think. And yet there needs to be some reform. So I'm not sure what the answers are. Tell me how Bike Law is looking at and how you are looking at these issues right now.
I agree completely, Diane, and the analogy that you use is exactly the one that I use, that idea of Newton's third law, right? That for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, that if the pendulum swings one way, it's going to come back in the other direction, the exact same way or to the same degree. We are adamantly against the idea of abolishing or at its most literal or simplest of interpretations, defunding police. I don't really think that is the intended or meant or the actual meaning of what people are saying when they're asking to defund the police. It's not necessarily about money as much as it is about reform. And so I personally have mixed feelings. You know, my experiences with law enforcement through Bike Law have all been, not all, mostly positive. The relationships that Bike Law has with law enforcement agencies all over the country are very, very positive. We need the police. Do we have challenges or complications through legal representation when trying to get an accurate police report or trying to have, you know, an officer that is not familiar with his or her bike laws relative to their jurisdiction, or who maybe doesn't have the resources, or, you know, who isn't familiar with bike culture or the significance of any of those things in the bike community? Sure. I mean, but I don't think that's a police issue. That's just a people issue, right? So we have more challenges and complications with anti-bike motorists than we do with police, believe it or not. You know, so we agree with you that there needs to be reform. There needs to be, you know, open, honest conversations in which the people that are being mistreated or the people who have never had historically a seat at the table are brought to the table to participate in important conversations where the end result is hopefully mitigating solutions to some of these problems. But we also support law enforcement. And so that it's a complicated position to have. You know, some bike manufacturers have made some pretty hardline statements. You know, Fuji Bikes made one last week, and we could spend another 30 minutes talking about whether or not their statement was disingenuous, but it was a statement nonetheless. And right. Then Trek Bikes followed, as they are the largest supplier for police bicycles in this country. You know, and we just generally have mixed feelings. You know, I don't know that I would hold Chevy or Ford or Dodge or any of the most popular manufacturers of pickup trucks and utility vans and work vehicles, I don't know that I'd expect them to make the same sort of statement. And those are the vehicles that are largely responsible for killing, you know, almost 1,000 members of our community last year. You know, so it's a difficult spot to be in, because I think our job as leaders in the community and members of the community is to be able to listen as much as we're able to speak on behalf of those who historically have not had a voice.
Well, it's interesting, having been in the bike business many, many years and having sold bicycles to police departments, the feedback we get from the police departments is how important their bike patrols are for a variety of reasons, and the training that these police officers go through to become bicycle patrol people is pretty intensive. And the fact that they would choose the one photograph of police holding up a bike that has Fuji on the down tube, which, first of all, why it says Fuji and not police is beyond me. I mean, that's Fuji's mistake. All these bikes should say police on them, but that's another issue. And not put into the narrative the fact that it is part of the training that they do to be able to use their bikes to do things like chase people, go down steps. So, you know, it was so out of context. And then, of course, you get the knee-jerk reaction from all of the manufacturers.
Right. And I, you know, I think that so much of what is being said these days is necessary. And then, on the other hand, so much of it is hyperbolic and inflammatory and unnecessary, and is just meant to be divisive, you know, to continue to promote this very, very polarized and politicized climate, when the reality is that, you know, and I've said this before, and it sounds, you know, maybe too fluffy, but, you know, until being faced with what's going on around us today, but the cycling community is by far the most diverse group or subgroup of people in this country that I've ever been a part of, ever. You know, we have every walk of life, every color, every creed, every shape, from sea to shining sea. You know, there is not a single subgroup of people in this country that doesn't have a community of cyclists. And so that's a really fantastic thing. And it also makes it a very challenging thing, because figuring out how to best meet the needs of and support, advocate for, and serve this community means being able to hold back at times, and then at other times, you know, really offer our support when it's needed. And I think that this is one of those times. I believe that, you know, the very fabric of this country is the idea or the ethos that we are going to protect and support the minorities, right? That those who have less, or those who are unable to speak for themselves, will have the strength and support from everyone else. Like, that is the American way. And that's something that has to be addressed. That's something that is ignored far too often. When we look at many, many, many places all over the country, you know, the way that people of color are disproportionately ticketed, profiled, you know, by law enforcement while riding their bicycles. When we look at the crash fatalities and the breakdowns in demographics, either socioeconomically or by race or ethnicity, and all of those things go together with the inequities in the way that communities are developed, the way that infrastructure, you know, that resources are provided. You know, I cannot think of very many places or cities, densely populated urban communities, where all different levels of bike education and advocacy are available to all different people.
Right.
You know, that's a problem. You know, redlining, which was a practice that began in the early 30s, is sort of, if we go all the way back there to identifying, you know, desirability in neighborhoods, you know, it's it's not all that surprising that we're seeing a lack of resources, a lack of infrastructure, a higher number of tickets and arrests and citations amongst these communities that, you know, are filled with people of color. You know, this has been something that historically has happened for a very, very long time.
Well, and for those who don't know, perhaps, what redlining was, and I say was, sort of not 100% sure that it doesn't sort of surreptitiously happen anyway. It is steering people to and away from certain communities because of who you are. Right. So redlining is, it is outlawed, and yet I've always had this feeling it still goes on. Mm-hmm. You know, I've only been exposed to discrimination in a very personal way a few times, but boy, I'll tell you what, it's like getting a slap across the face. It really hurts, really hurts. So, Rachel, what are you and Peter and Bike Law looking at going forward? I mean, now we're going to look at probably another wave of COVID-19. So another wave of people perhaps perishing because of who they are for no other reason than the color of their skin. People who are needing to social distance may not be able to work from home. Businesses that are closing. And then cycling comes in kind of an important way for a lot of things, recreation, health, transportation. What is Bike Law going to be looking at in 2020 going forward?
That's a really good question. And I don't know that we have the answer because there are so many factors that are unknown. And one of the things that we have been working on personally, professionally, and just as a community is the idea that we have to let go of certainty, right? There are some things that we absolutely know we know, which is that riding a bicycle is the fastest way to save the world. In if we look at every metric, that everybody that rides a bicycle to us is a cyclist. You know, those are things that are, those are non-negotiables for us. Like those are part of the things that we know inherently to be true. As far as how we continue to do the things that we've set out to do, given the nature of what's happening in the world around us, I think that we just have to be very, very flexible. I think that we have to be willing to speak up against injustice that may not appear to be directly related to cycling, but that actually is. I think that we need to be willing and courageous enough to essentially, for lack of a better term, you know, pick a side when it comes to things that are objectively right or objectively wrong. And to open the door even wider for people who may be angry or hurt or scared or confused to come through and ask questions and have conversations that are meaningful. You know, we have always believed that two heads are better than one, three are, you know, better than two. And so we have made overtures to Trek Bicycles. We've, you know, tried to re-energize this relationship that we've had for a very long time with USA Cycling, you know, because all of these organizations are making statements about how they feel about what's happening. And there's a very kind of general brushstroke statement about what they intend to do in the future. But I think that in order to be successful at those things, there need to be qualified experts sitting around helping to find solutions. And in order to find a solution, you have to be able to identify the problem.
You are so dead on. That just makes so much sense. And so reading all of these statements, which I have, you know, everyone that comes up, I read it. It's a little bit boilerplate. You know, I see, I see that, you know, we stand, we believe, we're going to do, we're going to commit, we're going to give. So, you know, it's the money where the mouth is, but it's not just that. It is an innate understanding that doesn't seem to be there. Do you think that the cycling community is sort of a microcosm of a larger worldview that could be a good place to actually affect some of these changes?
Absolutely. There is no doubt that it just, it goes right back to what I said before, which is that within the bike community in our country, it is the most diverse and most resilient community of people that I've ever met before. And that means that we have to be willing to let everybody that's a member of the community express how they're feeling and what their experiences are. We have to be willing to listen to things that are going to be difficult and uncomfortable. BikeWall isn't looking for leaders within our community to fall on their swords. We're just looking to move forward, but you've got to show us. You know, so we want to see people starting to ask the right questions, to do the research, to educate themselves on what it's actually like for more than half of our cycling community. That there are more than 50 million of us. Post-COVID, I'd be willing to say there's probably closer to 60 or 75 right. million of us. And before COVID, 50% of our community, you know, 25 million people are living at or below the poverty line. That's a really significant number of people that we consider brothers, sisters, friends. And, you know, we have to look at these numbers and statistics, and we have to use those as really important data points as we make decisions. You know, if Black families in this country are three times more likely to have a household without a car, well, then they're also three times more likely to use the bicycle for its utilitarian purpose. When we look at the last decade and the increase in cycling, it is the Black community that has contributed most to those growing numbers. It's not middle-aged white guys. But they're also being punished, whether it's through ticketing or harassment or being arrested for things, you know, for which they may or may not be guilty of. It creates this, it continues to push things down the wrong lane, you know. So our hope is that these statements that are being made by industry leaders and manufacturers and brands and bikes and bike people are going to be followed up with the quest for more knowledge, to really be plugged into what is actually happening as opposed to what's happening in their little bubble.
Well, I think that's an awesome place to end this conversation today. We speak with Rachel Maney occasionally. We should speak with her more often because clearly she is so plugged in, you know, as I hope many of my listeners are. People follow us very closely on our social media. I get lots and lots of responses to things that I post. And yesterday was a perfect example. If anybody did not read it, Peter Wilborn, who is the, I guess he's one of the founders of Bike Law. Yeah. Is he?
Yeah. He
posted a really, really good piece. And if you want to see it, you can come to the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page. Rachel, thank you so much for talking with me. I can't wait till we talk again, and hopefully we'll have some really good news and maybe like a vaccine. That would be a really good news, wouldn't it?
That would be, as long as, you know, as long as we can get people to take it, that herd immunity is a real kicker.
It is. Yes. And thank you so much. Say hello to Peter and take care of yourself. And we will speak again. Thank you.
You as well.
Alrighty.
Thanks so much, Diane.
Bye-bye. Okay. I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with Rachel. If you would like more information about Bike Law or would like to read Peter's blog about biking and civil rights, you can log on to bikelaw.com. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Sergeant Mike Ware. He's the VP and Public Information Officer for IPIMBA, one of the largest bike cop training programs in the country. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. You may have seen some of the photos, commentary, and swift condemnation of police bike patrols earlier in the week, and even I commented how I wouldn't want to be one of the bike companies whose bikes was being held up in some of those photos. But then I thought, wait a minute, I was proud to equip local bike patrols years ago, and we have a great bike patrol in our community. And I thought we should get another perspective. So I reached out to IPIMBA, the country's largest police bike training organization, for some perspective. Here is my conversation with the VP and Public Information Officer of IPIMBA, Sergeant Mike Ware. Hello, Sergeant Ware. Mike, is that okay? Call you Mike?
Mike is good.
All right. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. It's been quite the week for the police departments around the country. So I wanted to talk with you because I have spoken with people from IPIMBA before. You're the VP and Public Information Officer, and I would really like to get a perspective from you about the training and work that bicycle patrols get and do in the community. I think it's really important to have another voice in the conversation.
Well, I sure appreciate the time to talk about that, because if there's one thing that I really do enjoy talking about, it is working within the bicycle patrol.
Having sold bikes to police departments in Ohio, and my husband, who's originally from New York, was the mechanic for their police bike patrol, we both have a great amount of respect and of admiration for some of the things you do in the community. But we saw a photo this week that was really awful, you know, at least from the point of view of the way the media picked it up, this line of police officers holding bikes up as defensive weapons. And I know that policemen are trained to do specific things, and bikes are part of their gear, if you want to call it that. How do police officers who are trained to do bicycle officer work, how are they trained?
So the first thing to clarify, we said IPIMBA early on, and for those in the audience may not immediately recognize that as the International Police Mountain Bike Association.
Right.
And we're an organization. We're an organization of trainers, and we're not just police. So that's one thing that's really, we make the very specific distinction that we're a public safety. So when we're dealing with the training, and public safety has a wide front. I mean, everybody is pretty familiar with seeing, you know, the police officer riding down a bike down on patrol through a community, essentially waving and really doing a community service. And that's the ideals. That's where we started. But we also work with EMS, so emergency medical services, and that has a wide spectrum of different types of activities we do. And then if we move on to the security side of it, we have officers that are going out and, you know, working as a security function, which is different than law enforcement. And then we have rescue, which would be, you know, search and rescue aspect to it. So we cover a wide variety of things beyond the scope of just law enforcement. So when we're developing training, one of our absolute essential items is that we try to provide the best training possible. And with having the best training possible, you have to go to those who do the job. And so for all of those different areas that I just listed, and I hope that I got everybody, with all of those different areas, we drew experts from them, and we developed the training so they would have the skills to handle a bicycle in the aspect of public safety. So our main focus is learning the bicycle handling skills to be able to go out and essentially make it second nature. It is a mode of transportation without a doubt. It is a huge tool for us to get out there and really have conversation with people and be able to, you know, be literally face to face. And then you go, well, that's interesting. But I'm like, to get the full essence of it, you need to go out and see it. And I say that because I've done it for well over 25 years. I started with a base program in Washington, D.C., and Metropolitan Police, and we was second class that they ever put out. And I stayed with that for my entire career, working different aspects of it. So, you know, the training prepares you for physically how to ride the bike. And then, of course, we really have a strong aspect on being able to reach out, educate others about how to ride bikes properly. And in that sense of you know, we can always do a community service where somebody may be, you know, improperly riding in the wrong lane or something like that. And you just come up and talk to them. It doesn't have to be a police officer that does that. I mean, our EMS certainly are in that area of safety and say, hey, you know, we want you to ride safe. And so here we give suggestions, try to integrate into other programs and, you know, within the city or the county or the state or whatever, wherever you might live. And we try to get out there and make sure that our training is doing the same things that other folks that they're in the training world. So we don't limit ourselves, I guess is the easiest way to say it. But we focus on going out and doing physical patrol. I think that was probably the best term. It's probably the oldest term. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, so I see officers on bicycles as sort of community policing. So I think kids, for example, would be less likely to be afraid to walk up to somebody on a bicycle than if you were in a car. It takes some of the barrier away from somebody actually approaching an officer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's the first thing that I found. Sometimes I'm going to say I'm just not finishing the whole phrase for ITIMBA, because I have a great experience, but I found an organization, and I've been a part of the organization since 1998. It's a huge part of my life. As I'm sitting in my room and I look across the different pictures and things that I've been involved with, but it is a part of your lifestyle. It is a part of your actual being, is wanting to go out and serve the community. And it breaks down the barriers immediately. You know, if you've ever heard somebody saying that there was some form of intimidation, I think that we immediately break that barrier down by going, hey, that guy's wearing a pair of shorts and a bike helmet. And you know, he's pedaling up and he's drinking out of a water bottle. It's like, you know, it looks like they're having a good time. It looks like they're enjoying what they're doing. And then so many people come up and ask you questions, and you get that opening to have a conversation about something other than, excuse me, but you've broken the law, or excuse me, I see that, you know, you're going to need some medical attention. Excuse me, this is where you need to be, not in this location, the parking lot, but perhaps in the other part of this event. We get to have regular conversations like, what kind of bike are you riding? Where can I find things like that will help me learn how to ride better? Kids are looking at it, they're like, you know, I want to go play with the big guy on the bike. But, you know, look at her out there riding around, and look at the skill of that individual who's riding, you know, the bike. While they're out there servicing the community and working a main event where they're going to be able to give, you know, medical attention immediately, not waiting for an ambulance to get there, but they're on the site right away. So it just keeps opening door after door.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sergeant Michael Ware. He is the Vice President and Public Information Officer for the International Police Mountain Bike Association. When we saw some of the horrific scenes we've seen over the past week or so, and there were some policemen on bicycles and using their bicycles, I'm wondering how an officer is chosen to become a bike cop, because his or her duty is to be so much closer to the community and interact in a different way. So are there certain characteristics you look for in the officers who are trained as bike cops?
Well, when we refer to like the photo, and quite honestly, I'm not familiar with the exact photo because there have been so many out there.
Yeah, that's true.
And, yeah, and so you see the depiction, and you go, and first of all, you just kind of wonder what's happening. You know, I spent you know, over 30 years in public safety, so I've seen many photos and I've seen different information out there. So I might have a different view. And I look at it and I go, I'm not sure what's going on. But first and foremost, I can't comment on what any other law enforcement agency or any other emergency medical systems or anything, whatever they're doing. I can look at it and we could possibly discuss, you know, what's happening in the picture. But I don't know what led them to that. I don't know what the reasoning is or the rationale. But what I do know is that ITIMBA has specific training. We don't use the bikes for anything other than a tool and within transportation. So to see it used in that manner is not something we would do. And we don't train for it to be utilized in that fashion. Although if they were just lifting it up and placing it somewhere, that may be different. So I'd have to be cautious what I say based on what picture was being presented at the time. The training will not necessarily be different through ITIMBA, because ITIMBA has a standardized curriculum on how to do bike handling skills. we say without any record, and then of course you can always look on our website, not trying to plug too much, but we do have a statement that says what our agency feels or what our association feels should be the given word about our interaction within public order. And within public order, we do have a specific training, which is bicycle response team training. Within bicycle response team training, and I think that's what we're kind of aiming at, and I don't want to sail too far into it, but if you're talking about bicycle response team training, many agencies across the country will use that. And just so for everybody in the audience, public order is a big overview of different things that are done at events, things like First Amendment or large election parades, things of that sort, where we're going to have lots of bicycles out to help manage a crowd. So crowd management, in that term, we work towards trying to make it as safe as possible during the operations. We teach how to guide people through. Bicycles may be set up as a temporary barrier, so we would place it there, and then we can give directions and things of that nature. And we do have specific training, but what we don't do, and it's right down into the testing question of our training, we do not use bicycles as weapons. So as far as looking at a picture and saying that department is using bicycle in a certain manner, that's the agency's choice when they go to the basic training of bicycles and utilize ITIMBA, and that is a very large group of people. As far as organizations go, I think we could safely say we're the largest that does bicycle training for public safety. When that happens, we're very clear about where we start with the training and where we end. And where we may teach placement of bicycles to set up a temporary barrier, what we don't do is teach the actual connection or a physical impact with bicycle with people that are at a crowd. We're there to guide and direct them.
So is it possible that some of the pictures we've seen have been sensationalized, and in fact, officers were just trying to hold back a crowd, and all of a sudden, every bicycle company, I don't know if you know about this, but every single bicycle company now has come out with their Black Lives Matter statement. Now, having said that, I'm absolutely for that, but to sort of juxtapose that against police are bad and our bikes are good, you know, that kind of undermines the whole idea of having policemen on bicycles, which I've always thought was a good thing.
Well, I do appreciate that, because me too. And I mean, I have a love and a passion for using the bicycles on patrol. And of course, I've expanded it, and with my years in the organization with public safety and going out and working with EMS and security and, you know, search and rescue, and you kind of name it. I mean, there's a ton of things out there. Companies have agendas that they have to follow. And they have supporters, and they have thought. And I don't want to downsize any of that, because it's not for me to do that. I mean, my nature is in law enforcement, because that's where I spent most of my time. And I absolutely agree with the First Amendment. That's my opinion, not stating it on behalf of ATIMBA, but just clearly understanding people are going to say what they're going to say. And if somebody doesn't want to sell bikes to an agency, that's their choice. I can't say why they're doing that. I can't say it's the support of a cause. You know, their statement is their statement. The only thing that makes me sad is that you're taking away my ability to go out and work in a community that needs assistance because of a political statement. We have, you know, down in D.C., you have communities that are asking for the police to come in, and they thrive on having bicycles come in and patrol their communities, and they're happy when they roll in there. I work with medical services across the country, and, you know, and they're going, and I see them on events, and I see how they're servicing the community, and they're really happy to see them. And then you hear that, well, we're not going to sell products to those people anymore because of our political beliefs. And I'm like, I can't change somebody's mind based on their political beliefs, but I can say that when those items aren't sold, it's going to be really difficult for the people that are out there, which are the absolute majority of officers that are out there doing the job, and those technicians and the security and everybody that's involved in cycling to service the community. That's a much bigger audience. than what you're seeing in the news over an event that is, it is a spectacular event. It is definitely going on, and we're up to, I think, 9 or 10 days. But on any given year, we're patrolling the streets 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, providing services that are positive. And we're comparing it to segments of time where we can't even explain what that individual incident is causing. We're saying, based on these, you know, individual depictions, we're making a decision. Not my choice to be made, but to hopefully enlighten people and realize there's a much, much bigger picture than what's going on in any one of those specifics, in a specific incident.
So true. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Sergeant Michael Ware. He is with the International Police Mountain Bike Association. And I have to say that that's an excellent explanation of, you know, you take a snapshot in time, forgetting that there's all this other stuff going on around it, like the rest of the year, the rest of the days, the rest of the months and weeks. I can totally get it. I mean, I live in a community that has police on bikes, and I appreciate them very, very much. I'm wondering how people can connect with their bicycle police officers, and are there changes that need to happen in the communities? I mean, we know that people of color, for example, don't have the same kind of transportation opportunities that, you know, your suburban white middle class people have. And so I see that maybe there's a different response necessary for your inner city or your less wealthy people. So are officers connecting with communities on bicycles, and do some changes need to happen there also?
So when we talk about making changes happen in the community, I would only support that we make positive changes in the community. I was actually being asked some questions about it, and they were like, would you want to have a discussion, and who would you want to have a discussion with? When we talk about training, and I'm going to try and not go too far off topic here, but when we develop training, we have to reach out to everybody. So whenever we're having a problem, the first step in resolving a problem is figuring out what the problem is, and then going in with a group of people that want to make a positive change. It's easy to find the negative. I don't think we're going to have any trouble finding people to give the negatives of what's going on. But when we start talking about going into the community with bicycles, I've had nothing but positive contact when I'm doing community-related activities. Most recent ones, we had the DC bike ride, and it's a big ride. It's starting to be an annual event. It's a beautiful celebration of riding through the city, and people get the opportunity to ride the roads through the city, and then you can ride your bikes, and it's all been blocked off, and basically they get to ride on all the roadway. And you tapped on this one, said people don't have that opportunity. Well, the police department gave donated bikes and then volunteered me and a few other officers, and we went out with a group of kids. They're young boys with bikes that had been donated because they didn't have the means for it. They got to go out and ride an actual route 20 miles, which was really impressive. They had a great time, and then the greatest part about it is they're donated bikes. Here you go, take it home. Here's your helmet, ride safely. So we're out all the time doing that, and I can't tell you how many officers have come to me and, you know, said, we want to do a little bit more on maintenance because, you know, yeah, we need to learn how to do our bikes. But I said, but I keep getting stopped on the street where this kid wants me to work on his bike. And, you know, and I'm like, right, that's part of what we do. We're sending a positive message out there that we're here to help, which is actually DC's slogan, and I didn't even need to do it. But that's a whole purpose of being public safety is to go out and help people. Here's a mechanism to reach out to a really cheap form of transportation, and so we can hopefully open the doors to as many people as possible. If you're talking about a tool to get, you know, the attention of, you know, a community that's in need of transportation, bikes without doubt are going to be one of the greatest things to offer that ability of transportation. And then we could get into bike lanes, but I think I take too much of your time.
Well, bike lanes are a whole nother subject, and we talk about it a lot on this show. So yeah, that is another whole topic, and we could probably go for hours on that one. My main concern was to sort of put to rest some of the upset and anger that everybody's feeling about what's been going on as it sort of decides, okay, we're going to defund the police and we're going to abolish the police. I mean, it's ridiculous talk, I think, to the extreme. I don't think people understand what they're saying and or what they're meaning. But I hate to see bicycles sort of used as a quote-unquote weapon in that fight. So I wanted to get your view, because I've reached out to IPIMBA in the past, and it's been always a good organization to explain what's going on. So I really appreciate you talking with me about it.
Well, thank you for having me. I mean, and I'm sure that I'll have many friends that are going to be listening to the show. And the thing is that, I mean, I and all of the members of IPIMBA, we are so passionate about what we do. I mean, we really, really do care, and we want to be out there, and we want to go on patrols, and we want to go out and serve, you know, the public. We wouldn't be doing this if we didn't want to do it. And then you get to do your life passion, which is your job, and then you get to do it on a something that you absolutely love, which is going out and riding the bike. I mean, just the sheer joy of going to work and riding is just, it's awesome. And I mean, I'm not making this up. I mean, I really feel that way. And what I loved about joining IPIMBA, and I did a long time ago, is I found all these other people that wanted to provide the same service. And then we're a training organization, so we're spreading that message left and right. So that's the part that, you know, sorry, I'm going to ramble on, because I love what I'm doing and working with folks. And I love the fact that you brought us here to talk about it. So thank you.
Well, you have to remember that all we talk about on this show is bicycles, and that's pretty much all I've talked about for my entire adult life. Who would have thought that when I was in high school? Well, we've been talking with Sergeant Mike Ware. He is the VP of IPIMBA, the International Police Mountain Biking Association, and obviously the Public Information Officer. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it, and I'll say hi to my bike cops as soon as I see them go by.
Well, thank you. And I know they're going to enjoy getting it, you know, a nice wave. And thanks for being out here and letting us have an opportunity to speak. Really do appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. Take care and stay safe.
All
righty.
Yeah, thank you. You
Bye-bye.
Too.
Sergeant Mike Ware is the VP and Public Information Officer for IPIMBA, the International Police Mountain Bike Association. If you're interested in learning more about the organization and its work, you can log on to ipmba.org. My thanks to Mike and to Rachel Maney from Bike Law for their perspectives and expertise. I did say that we were going to speak with our national cyclocross champion, Clara Hunzinger, this week, and in fact, I did. But I also felt she deserves the spotlight, and we'll have her conversation on the show next week. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember that you can always join our conversations on our Facebook page and send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. Or you can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.